you know I done changed my way of living. Oh, it hit my mind so. I used to get up early in the morning, baby, honey, for the rooster crow for day. I used to get up early.
Henry St. Clair Fredericks, also known as Taj Mahal, born in the deep, 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 deep south of Harlem. His mother was a gospel singer, his father a West Indian musician, and he has never left the art form. And he likes what he calls natural blues. And that's a good example. It's called Done Changed My Way of Living. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, May the 7th, and the airwaves belong to you. So let's see what you have to say at 1-888-874-4888. Just put forward your brilliant analyses and considered opinions of current events and issues that you think warrant closer attention. And let's see what people think about that. 888-874-4888. Quite a few things going on. And I was wondering whether you have been paying attention to the news coverage of the big terror story that unfolded in Boston on April 15th. You notice it's kind of dead. It's winnowed down because there's something going on. And here's what's going on. It's called embarrassment. The story broke with such an extraordinary force because, of course, you know, the media looked at this as yet the greatest example since the World Trade Center attacks at 9/11. And in a way, they were privately hoping that that's what it would turn out to be. And that's why such a big contingent of reporters from everywhere snatched up to cover this, every aspect of the story. And, of course, all of the information came from official sources. But official sources had a problem. And official sources themselves overestimated what was going on. This is not to suggest, by the way, that people who would actually think I'm saying this, but so I have to explain it. It is not to suggest that this was an unimportant event or that it was a small event. We look at the nature of it, and we see that, in effect, what happened was the intelligence gathering authorities, basically, this one slipped through their fingers, and they had it. They had the ability to head it off, but did not. And so they had to scramble. And even in scrambling, they looked, if you paid attention to how this thing unfolded and the logistical difficulties that they were experiencing, it said that all of the improvements that should have occurred after 9/11 simply were not being evidenced. You know, in fact, I thought it was very interesting that of all people, of all papers, the Wall Street Journal is calling for a congressional investigation. And Time Magazine has said pretty much the same thing that I was saying, that thank God that we had something to respond with, that we did have the personnel and so forth. But if anybody were to be looking at that incident with a very close up, it would actually have been very disconcerting, because it said to anybody looking that closely, we simply are not ready. Here are two novices, and they caused an entire region, and literally, by extension, you can argue that they caused the entire country to be on alert, when it didn't have to unfold like that. It didn't have to unfold that way at all. So it was interesting to me that after saying that, you see the Wall Street Journal is calling for a congressional investigation. They said that they called it the Keystone Cops routine. They said the level of performance and the bungling of the anti-terrorist forces made the country look like this was a case of the Keystone Cops. So, you know, every now and then I say one or two things that make sense. Not because I'm looking for in fact, I was not expecting the Wall Street Journal to be that harsh about it, nor was I expecting Time Magazine to be that harsh about it, but it was so clear. It was just so clear. And then, of course, we had the police commissioner and the mayor of the city of New York. I don't know what they were thinking. It's called intelligence for a reason, folks, to announce, oh, yeah, and New York was an intended target. We don't need to know that. Only the people who are to counter it need to know it. I mean, we really don't need to know all that stuff. But this is the way things work. So, 888-874-4888, what I'm expecting is that you are prepared to defend your point of view. You have a point of view. That's important. To have a point of view, it's immaterial whether people agree or disagree. It is important only that you defend your position by putting forward facts that suggest that you have what I would call a considered opinion. Mike from Michigan, you're up first to bat, sir.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, very well.
Yes, I have a son that's about to go to college, and I'm going to all these colleges and listening to Gary Noll and you and this progressive radio network, and all the colleges just seem to be brain dead, and I don't know if I even want to pay for it. I would like to know what you think about it, and they're not teaching the kids what they need to know.
Well, what does your son want to do?
He wants to be a broadcaster.
Okay, so have you sought out a reputable school that has a good reputation for producing broadcasters?
Well, the one school that we sought out, they gave us $20,000 and they want $28,000 more a year, and it's kind of unbelievable.
What? Oh my gosh.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
That's an amazing thing. Would this be his first time in college, or is it transferred?
His first time in college. I just want him to, you know, give back to society, because everything is just so messed up. And I just want him to, you know, I just want him to give back. And I talk to these nice people in the school, and I tell them some stuff, and they just seem like they don't know anything about it, and it's just... I don't know. I'm just looking for a good education so he can go on and try to change things, because these kids are going to get hit hard.
Well, I praise you for that, but I want to also give you some a healthy tip. Don't expect any college really to equip your son to the point where he's going to change things. That is a personal commitment. That is a purely personal commitment. I used to teach journalism. In fact, I started my own program that was rated the best trading program in the entire state of New York. And I also taught at college, and I had an entirely different approach to teaching. But it is not typical. It was not at all typical in the way that people are commonly taught. So I would ask that your son really do some research. There's broadcasting, and then there's broadcasting. If you take a look at a lot of the broadcasters today, many of them were not well-trained. They're not well-trained, and the industry itself is not demanding very much training. It assumes that this is an easy thing to do, which is why you'll have the novelty of a Kardashian posing as a reporter or, somebody with a name. They just need the name these days, and they get into the broadcasting business. So your son needs to take a good hard look at places that prepare him, that will prepare him with the skills that he would need as a broadcaster. And he need not wait to get into college to do that. He can start by doing independent projects and gather his experience that way, get used to the industry. But I don't want to sound like a wet blanket, but I have not really seen, lately especially, where broadcasting as a whole, journalism as a whole, is actually being taught to the point where a person understands what the industry is. What they do is they give you what you need to know to get hired for a job.
Yes.
And they're, that's not what it is. So if he has a real passion for it, have him do some deeper research.
And would you advise going into a college that he doesn't have to go in massive debt for?
I wouldn't. That's not my place. The idea is what he wants to do.
Yes.
And if he wants to do it badly enough, the most important thing for him to do is to get oriented. And the way he can get oriented is seeking out those institutions that have a reputation for producing people, because they take the industry in this, very seriously, and engage in a lot of talking. I'll tell you how I chose a doctor. I actually called up quite a few and asked for an informational interview. Every doctor said to me, I've never heard about that. I said, well, I understand you never heard about it, but I want to know how you practice medicine, because I will not be your typical patient, so I want to know that you won't be my typical doctor. And when the one doctor said, he was so impressed with that, that I called up to ask for an informational interview, and on the basis of that decided, well, okay, you'll be my doctor. He said he'd never experienced that in his life. So the same thing with your son. Have him engage in a lot of talking with people in the industry so he could get a sense of where he wants to go.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Patricia from New York, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, you, Trace.
Good afternoon.
As we were talking about the fact that the U.S. finds itself with a little egg on its face, mm-hmm. A friend of mine always says, there are never any permanent friends, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests.
Yeah.
And this was, instead of wasting the taxpayers' money on a congressional investigation, because at this point it just serves absolutely no purpose. Russia gave us the heads up on the older brother. But because the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is not the best, they didn't trust the Russians. And they didn't trust the information and the intel that the Russians gave them. And that's really what this is all about. I mean, if this had been France or Great Britain giving them the intel, their friends who they trust, they probably would have conducted, a much more detailed investigation. But at this point, we'll never know. But I do suspect that, unfortunately, it was the origin of the source that that directed their cursory, investigation into the older brother. So at this point, I mean, I don't want my taxpayer dollars wasted on some congressional investigation that's absolutely not going to yield anything substantive. I think what I'm certainly more concerned about are these, you know, sanctioned direct or indirect airstrikes, over sovereign countries like Syria. That's more of a concern to me because, you know, that policy is really fraught with danger.
Yes, but we should automatically suspect that the United States did not, it was not a surprise to the United States that the airstrikes were occurring.
I guess not. I mean, I guess not. You know,
this is how it works. Everybody, the one thing we always must remember is that all governments, every single one of them, all governments lie. They all lie. And it goes back to the old Socratic idea of the noble lie, that if you lie in the interest of the gallant interest of your country, then it's a noble lie. But it's a lie. So it is disingenuous for the United States to maintain a position that, well, gee, they had no idea that Israel was going to do this.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure.
In the same way
I don't think anyone believes that. I don't think any intelligent person believes that.
But they have to play it that way because what is at stake is complete loss of confidence in government. I mean, the public is close to having a complete loss of confidence, but it will be assured if these cozy relationships were actually laid bare, which is why when these hearings occur on Thursday, for whatever it's worth, is going to give us an inside view of how governments lie. And, they engage in this all the time. This is what they do. This is normal for them.
But you, Therese, we already know that from Colin Powell at the UN with weapons of mass destruction, you, Therese. I mean, how often are we going to play this card?
Well, we play this often because, don't forget, this is a very important thing. People will be very uncomfortable with the idea of expressing what would be considered unpatriotic thoughts. At a time like this, when the country is under, remember, we talked about that in Boston, the first role of the press is to whip up nationalistic fervor. We're all Americans. We are one America. The president said it. You know, everybody is got over whatever hurdles and problems they had, and they acted as one unified nation. Great. So we achieved the ideal theoretically, but they would not like that to fall apart. So they capitalize on these things. And in that atmosphere, while they say one thing and they pander to our patriotic sensibilities, they continue to operate the same way they've been operating all those years.
I'm waiting to see.
We'll soon find out that the U.S., in fact, did know about the Israeli strikes. There's no way that it would have happened without the United States knowing.
I'm waiting to see a pushback by the American people, you trees. I'm waiting.
Thank you so much, Patricia,
for
your call.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. From the great city of Dallas, Sarah, you're up.
Greetings to you, Therese.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, you, Therese, you say this is any topic, right? As long as you can hold your...
Any topic. This is your time.
Okay, you, Therese. The topic that I have to discuss here is this situation with Sister Asada Shakur and what has happened and what we are seeing being played out before us. I listened to the interview that you had with Attorney Maddox on Friday. And I don't know if you know Lennox Hines, who is the attorney for Sister Shakur, and perhaps you might want to see to get him as a future guest on this show.
I know him very well. In fact,
okay.
His firm was my lawyer.
Yes, I thought that you would since he's in that tri-state area. But the question that I have and what is being played out in this media is that here it is, this woman who is in Cuba. She is they're trying to make her this black face to be the face of terrorism. This woman has not done any act of violence. She is alleged to have killed a cop when it was proven that she was not the one to do it. Even the so-called survivor, the trooper who survived, said she was not, because she was shot with her hands in the air. They found no ballistic evidence to show that she was the one who killed this cop. So since when is this woman who had to escape because of what was done to her in a male prison, because here this is a black woman, they're treating black women as if though we are men, that we are not to be treated with any reverence. She was incarcerated in a male prison. She was in solitary confinement. She escaped. She managed to found refuge in Cuba as a political prisoner. Now here it is that we have
a political, she was granted political asylum, not as a political prisoner.
Political asylum, excuse me, wrong terminology. She was granted that asylum in there because it seems that all the black members of either the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army, if they have not been incarcerated, they have to either leave this country or they've been killed. So it seems that they are trying to make black people the face of terrorism. Once again, they're trying to paint this label. Right, all of the auspices of having the so-called first African-American president, the African Attorney General, who is the head of the Department of Justice. Now, here it is that you had it's this black FBI agent to come out and make this statement to put this bounty of $2 million on our head, so for us to have some overzealous idiot to go and try and do bodily harm to the sister, or possibly for them to put drones in the sky, because we know this is all about going after Fidel Castro.
Well, the first thing we need to ask is, and we will get to the discussion because there are pieces of it that still need to be fleshed out, but with what is interesting is that, strictly speaking, all right, this concerns a crime. And the crime, if we were to just do, strictly speaking, is the shooting death of a police officer, allegedly by Assata Shakur. Now, when the government takes it out of that milieu and now classifies it as an act of terrorism, mm-hmm. we have some problems.
Exactly, sister. That's exactly.
Because now we then could apply it to say, if that is terrorism, mm-hmm. then the African American Latino communities specifically can absolutely charge the government, all these police, Rodney King and Amadou Diallo, and all these cases of police executions of private citizens. We should therefore re-label these things as acts of terrorism.
Which is exactly what they are, Utrecht. This is acts of terror because they have been terrorizing this community. The black and Latino communities have been overly policed. They have this use of force that is only used on us. You don't see it being done in the Caucasian community. It's not done in those communities. Even the lower echelon white communities, they're not so heavily policed as they do these communities. You can't even walk more than two black males cannot walk down a street before they have to be stopped and questioned as to what it is they're doing, where they're going about, because they're perceived to be threats. But you can have six and seven white boys walking on the street, yelling and horse playing and doing whatever, and they're not going to be stopped and questioned as to what their motives are and what it is they're going to be up to. It's okay for them to horse around, but our children, they cannot just be...
All right, but you're stating the obvious. I have to say, you're stating the obvious. Stick with your point of Assata Shakur. You took us on a scenic route there for a little while.
Yes, ma'am. But I'm back on the
What is the point you're making about Assata?
The point that I'm making about Assata, Utrecht, is they're trying to put black people in this image of putting the face of terror on us while we have these so-called black people in power. Because it is all not only trying with the Cuba situation to with Fidel Castro to get him out and for them to get control of the backyard of South America, which they consider to be their backyard, but it's also
That is very insulting to most nations to be considered
exactly.
or to be referred to as America's backyard.
The backyard of the United States, because they don't say that to Canada, but they're saying that to these countries who are much older than the U.S. and Canada, that they are their backyard, which is, as you're correct. But not only with the Cuba situation, Utrice, because now we have places like all these so-called black Muslim organizations, like the Nation of Islam, because already they have them listed on the terrorism list with the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as being a terrorist group. The Nation of Islam has never went after any white people. They have never bombed. They have never killed. They have never done anything terroristic to anyone in this country. And for them to be listed as a hate group, as a terrorist group by the SPLC, amongst other things, I see a trend going, Utrice, and it's not only with the so-called Muslims in Asia, but they're trying to pull in black people in it as well to remind folks that we are still the number one target. We are people that need to be looked at, and therefore, with Sister Asada Shakur being pulled in by virtue, it's a reference to all black people.
Well, okay, you made your case. I still think you had one little way to go, and that is, so what is to be done about it? You didn't address that part.
Okay.
But I think what you've done is enough to contextualize the issue, and, you know, I don't fundamentally disagree with that. I see that, in fact, we just discussed it. If it is to be considered, if somebody's going to arbitrarily use this word, this is why we had the program defining what terrorism is. If the shooting death by any citizen is going to be classified as an act of terrorism, then we should now reclassify the acts, the shooting deaths of citizens by police also as acts of terrorism? That's the
exactly.
question. Thank you so much for raising it, though. Thank you.
You are so welcome, Utrice.
Thank you. Harvey from Berkeley, how are you today?
Hi, Utrice, and thanks for being you.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to talk about something that I consider very, very important, and it's our feeling of disconnection. In a sense, there's a whole industry based on making us feel unconnected to each other, economically, sexually, racially. The Republicans, they really work at it, divide and conquer. But the truth is that, you know, in the old Newtonian physics, we are separate. Everything is quantifiable and measurable, and we're all separate from each other. But in the new quantum physics, there's something called quantum entanglement. And an example of it is when you take two electrons that are entangled with each other, if they're separated across the room, across the city, across the universe, that when you affect one, the other is immediately affected, instantaneously. Like if you flip the polarity in one electron, the other will flip the other way. So the thing is that everything is entangled. And according to our scientists, all the universe sprang forth from a primordial atom. And if that's true, then we're all entangled, not just feeling that we're entangled, but we're physically entangled according to the new quantum physics. So I say strength through connection, strength through entanglement, and we're all connected. So that's I live the entangled life. And all the forces out there that are trying to separate me from everything else and everybody else, it doesn't work because I am physically connected to everyone else. And so that's my strength through
but
connection.
But I have to ask you this question.
Yes.
I mean, the theory sounds great. However, transliterated into our real world today, where we are the byproducts of centuries of conditioning to accept distance from each other, to accept isolation, to accept what is known here as rugged individualism. On a country predicated on these concepts and precepts, how do you propose to live and to propagate this idea of quantum entanglement?
Well, I'm propagating it right now by talking to you and the millions of listeners who are hearing it, and perhaps they will go on to tell others, and maybe some people will write articles about it. But I feel that this is the world we're living in. It used to be Newtonian. We were all separate, but now we're all entangled. And so I feel that this is my feeling of connection. I'm not lonely. I don't feel lonely. I feel... we're all connected, so that's the new my new reality according to quantum physics, and I feel that it gives me strength because no matter the forces that come against me, I'm connected to you and you're connected to me, and it's physical. It's on the physical plane.
Okay, I'm accepting again. I have no trouble with your theoretical definition.
Yeah.
In other words, could you give me a real hard example of how you put your theory into action every day?
Well, a good example is that when I approach people, I generally approach like a certain familiarity, not a disconnection. It's not the other that I approach, it's myself. And when I walk down the street, I will smile at people, I'll look in people's eyes. If people are coming past me through a doorway, I'll stop and open the door for them. In a thousand little ways, I'm connecting. And it seems to make a big difference in my daily life. I feel really, really connected with other people all day long.
Do you ever believe that you... with your quantum entanglement, how would you respond in a situation where you will enjoy something that, or privilege or right that somebody else will not enjoy? How do you deal with that? Do you entangle with the system because it benefits you, or do you entangle with the person and you deny yourself a privilege?
Well, I entangle with the person, and I'm always entangling with the person. I don't know. It's when the waiter's at the table, I'm entangling with the waiter. I don't know. I feel for everyone. I'm interested in everyone. Everyone is important to me. It's my life.
I really
do. It's my life. It's all these people, everything. It's my life. It's not just me. It's not me against them. It's me with them.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
If you ever run into a dilemma, I mean, would you be able to call us and tell us how you dealt with it, and how you put, or how your theory, or how your life philosophy came to the test, and how you dealt with it?
Okay. Well, I don't know if I can come up with something right now, but I just want you to know.
No, I'm saying at some point in the future.
Yes, yes.
Just make a note of it, because it would be interesting to see how on a practical level you deal with what for many people would be a dilemma.
May I just say one more thing? My saying or my motto is, it's nice to be nice.
Thank you. It's very good.
Thank you.
Very good motto. All righty. You're listening to PRN.FM. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and it is your program today to air what you consider issues of serious importance that you would like to share. Michael from New Jersey, let's hear from you.
Hi, Utrice.
Hello.
I actually, agree quite a bit with your last caller. And as a matter of fact, I was also going to say that we're kind of trying to solve Newtonian problems, and we're providing Newtonian solutions in a quantum world that needs to have quantum conversations and quantum solutions. And so it becomes difficult, and probably we need a new paradigm to address the things that your last question was about.
It's so funny. I don't think we need anything new. I think we have all the ammunition we should ever need in life to make some decent choices by now. We've been on the planet for quite enough time to have gathered that information. And we always have to ask ourselves, why is it, with all that we know, all that we have, all the resources that are at our disposal, why aren't we more civilized?
Well, that's an excellent question to ask. And, you know, I think that we avoid some things by confusing, you know, I guess human beings are symbolizing creatures, and we take the symbols in place of the actual thing, and sometimes we mistake the symbols for the thing. I mean, there's an actual tree, but the word tree represents the tree, and we forget that the word is not the tree. And oftentimes, you know, because of our nature as symbolizing creatures, this is something that we do on a regular basis. And we're confusing, you know, a quantum world with a structure, a Newtonian structure that was put in place for us to communicate and to talk to each other. And one of the things I was saying that might move us in towards a new kind of way to communicate is, you know, oftentimes when you see on television, you see the talking heads and they speak in such a narrow bandwidth of possibility that nothing that they say raises an eyebrow. It's always, you knew they were going to say it. It was just an expectation based on, you know, what's already in the news, let's say. And the debate is always put forward as black and white and like a bipolar debate, with one side wants to prove my assertion and disprove the other position. And I think we need to move more away from debate. I know it probably doesn't sell commercials on TV, but, you know, because you try to raise people's, their testosterone or something, to get them to buy a product on TV. And you have to get their juices flowing, and a debate may be one way to do that. But it does, I don't think it moves I don't believe it moves in the direction of finding quantum solutions. Whereas I think dialogue is much better.
Dialogue is much better, but we are socialized, yes, as a country, because all countries, all forms of government in one way or the other exert a socializing power because it is the one way to maintain order. So there is a thing that the government, no matter how small, no matter how large, there is a culture and there is a prevailing philosophy, and our job as members of whichever society it might be is to first understand the rules and to accept them. We may not agree with them, but that is the insistence that we accept these rules. The rules are not necessarily good ones, but we do not grow into thinking that it is possible to have entirely different rules and still live a decent life. We never, you know, we're not taught that. As Americans, for example, what do you think you were taught? What does it mean to you when you say you're an American?
Well, it's a nationalistic concept.
Sure.
That, you know, that I identify with my country, and so it's kind of a nationalistic thing that I put a circle around myself and my country and my family and et cetera. And these mm-hmm. are, you know, boundaries. It's an actual boundary or a border, you know, put a fence around it too and call it a country, call it a nation. And I'm an American. And so, okay, then it's American as apple pie, it's baseball, Pepsi Cola, et cetera. So there are these images, okay, of being an American. You're going to eat a hot dog, which I don't do, but you're going to do something American.
But these are more than images, because, believe it or not, when you go abroad, and you can sense it even more sharply, when you go abroad, you like the idea that people see you as American because you enjoy a certain profile. You are given a certain level of respect just by saying I'm an American. Mm-hmm. And people behave in very odd ways toward you, almost idolizing you, and not even knowing whether you're a bank robber. They don't care if you're an American. You know, that's what they relate to. And so we are conditioned. We like that, by the way. We like the idea of sharing, even if it's not real. Okay, it may not be real. There are many African Americans I know who are unbelievable. They simply have not understood it. They have not internalized the fact that they are oppressed people. They don't get that yet.
Well, how real is it, though, being an American? Okay, well, it's real if I get a Social Security check, etc. But the ideal, the image of me being an American, I mean, if I look carefully, is there any American, in me, actually, besides those?
It's because in America, you have a definition of what it means to be American. Outside of America, there's a whole other definition that applies.
Right.
In America, you're just, one more schmo like the rest of us. But just the same, we have rules that we have to follow. If you were a white person, I'm a black person, another person is a Puerto Rican, another person is Asian, we are American, but we're not all American. You see? All at the same time.
Right, right.
So this is the dilemma.
Yeah. But I think, getting back to the debate issue, if you want me to stay on the phone, I thought that the dialogue is a better way to, for example, with this business of Syria, you turn on the TV and there's only political people and military people there. What about the environmental people? What about the anthropologists? What about the religious people? What about the sociologists? And the journalists are really political people. They're not really journalists. I don't know. I can't untangle the journalism from what these people are doing in terms of putting forth a certain spin on what they're talking about, a way of looking at it, a belief system that they want to reinforce in people, that they feel that that belief system's already there, but they want to, strengthen it and reinforce it. In any of these issues, like the Boston bombing, the Syrian situation now, as if it's only a military and a political kind of thing, and so it's a vastly reduced kind of thing. Now, if you go on Charlie Rose's at the round table, okay, or Bill Moyers, it's a little bit more of a dialogue. But if you were to have a real dialogue, you would involve the various people, economists, all these people, and regular schmoes, mm-hmm. What's your position? And you could have a real dialogue not having an answer in the mind, proving and disproving as in a debate, but a dialogue is looking for an answer that you don't have, that you don't know yet. So I don't know that things could switch to having that as being the main way to go about having conversations.
Well, what you're saying is actually it's very deep. And what you're saying is that you personally, individually, have evolved beyond the point of expectation of systems. We are the product of systems. Our systems condition us, like you say, you have hundreds of makes of cars that you could choose from to buy. You have hundreds and thousands of makes of clothing from different designers. Politically and socially, you are to function in a narrow, very narrow track. Like politics, we could only have two parties. As complex as we are, we are not allowed to deal with more than two, because somehow we'll be overloaded with choice and choice suddenly becomes bad. You can't be given any number of social tools to deal with because you are to be conditioned to be, what did I just say, American. When you're American, you can't have all these things cluttering up your mind. Somebody has to tell you what being an American is. Somebody has to name things for you and give you the power by extension. You derive your sense of where you fit in this society based on predetermined social constructs. You have nothing to do with it. But the fact that you are asking these questions actually is an exception to the rule. You are, in fact, American exceptionalism at work.
I hope not.
In the good sense. Thank you, Michael.
Okay,
very nice talking with you.
Thank you. Bye.
From the People's Democratic Republic of Brooklyn, we have Orville.
Good afternoon, Yatrice.
Hello. How are you?
I am well. I wanted to just jump right in. The time is limited. In terms of quantum entanglement, I forgot which one of your, which one of the people who spoke, what's his name, but I thought that was wonderful and beautiful, and I appreciated that.
Harvey.
Yes. I didn't even hear you because I'm so focused trying to get this in. But, excuse me. And then I heard you mention oppression. And that black folks, black Americans, black people in this country are oppressed.
Yes, I believe that.
Mm-hmm, and sometimes people, they don't want to talk about it, and including people of color. But I find that most white folks don't want to talk about it. And if they do, it's very superficially.
I think they're oppressed too, by the way, but in a different way. They are oppressed because they have been given that construct. The social and political construct as their rightful inheritance. And of course, we've been given the flip side of the coin. That construct is exactly what we are not supposed to have. See? So it works on both sides of the coin.
Oh, very true. But I'm thinking that as black folks, as, you know, in this country, that we need to help them. That's what I'm thinking. And we can only help them by helping ourselves. And in terms of it's not being dealt with. And we've been here for hundreds of years, and it's not being dealt with. It will not be dealt with. From my point of view.
But Orville, why should it be the point of the oppressed to help the oppressor?
Well, because when we, when a society is judged by how I think, by how the least amongst it is being treated, and since they will not treat us well, I think we have to treat ourselves well, and then the rest of them will benefit. And I think we do have that ability, that energy, that power to do this for ourselves if we focus and be very real.
But why do we not find, this is the thing, we find more examples of that, the messianic approach to life, the evangelical approach to life, that we, if we love people hard enough, even if to the last breath, we could love them hard enough that they could in turn love us. But it doesn't work. It hasn't worked for centuries.
That's what my point is, that we have to take care of ourselves. And my thing now is to be very factual about where we live in the society.
Why don't we challenge those on the other side who are equally oppressed? I would say they are very much oppressed.
Oh, yes,
when you constrict your world, that it should be demanded of them to do the work in their communities.
But I want to give my point.
You want to get your point? Okay.
Okay,
go ahead. So you're being a rugged individualist right now, but it's all right.
Mm-hmm. So I think that since if we begin to really be factual and assemble the facts, when we look at the society in which we live in, the judicial system and the enforcement system is amok. It's just total things are wrong. The healthcare system, if we begin to really take a look at it, we see that it's full of lies, from the cancer industry to everything.
Yeah.
And, the educational system, So when we look at the whole structure of it, we see lies, and we see things that are unfactual. And I think once we begin to deconstruct that, then we are okay with that. We understand that that is true. Then we can begin to say, okay, so rugged individualism does not really work, because when you look at quantum entanglement, we're all connected. So
but
if I
see,
was to take care of my family, if I was to take care of my community, let's just say five people came together and got a house or rented a house or leased a house, and then they wanted to increase the quality of life and the and quality of living and the standard of living, what all that stuff. How would you then, because given the society and where we're headed, I think, is that we're going to crash, because we cannot continue to rape the environment and spend so unwisely. So what can we do with less money? Can we use less money to raise our standard of living and quality of life?
Look,
in terms
of
child care, elder care?
I don't see that it is a sequential thing. Life is not a sequential thing. You have to be able to dance on every side of the fence that you possibly can at the same time.
That's what I'm believing. That's what I'm saying that this does.
So, mm-hmm. So what my point is, if there's a good idea, your job is to just go ahead and get it done. Don't wait for anybody.
But I thought that this, in this particular dialogue, that I got a chance to talk and describe this, and I thought that's what this was about.
yes, but the point ultimately is we must own our.
Oh, definitely,
ideas.
I agree with you. But I thought that this particular show was.
You mean the proselytizing?
No, that this particular, that the point of this particular program is that we get on and we can give an idea and we can, and you can look at it and we can deconstruct it. And I thought that's what this was about.
We can do that too. But mm-hmm. at the point we're talking today, today being an introduction, I would be happy if people want to continue the dialogue. Let's do it. The whole point of this program is to encourage debate, frank debate.
Yeah.
We're not insulting anybody, but we're being open, which, by the way, is a new concept. We talk past each other all the time, over, under, around each other, but we never talk with each other. So this is important work to do within our specific communities and within the larger community as well. I believe, I've had that problem with journalism, let's say. There are many white journalists who become authorities on black issues because it is so easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
They can just come in and absorb something and they get people who bend backwards to accommodate them.
That's
so
the nature
forth.
Of the
I've
relationship
seen that happen
in many
all the time.
Different ways, yes. Mm-hmm.
But I tell you this, I stood up once and I said, there was this a young woman who was quite famous as the big liberator. And I said, wait, all of your stories are done in, quote, third world countries and whatnot. What is your evidence that you have gone into your own community and faced it with its racism? What stories could you point to? What body of work can you deliver where you have shown that your journalistic skills were applied to trenchant, aggressive racism in your own community? And the place went so quiet, as they say, you could hear a rat pee on cotton.
It's always that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the point is, we have to withdraw into our communities for some time to examine the contradictions, and we
yes.
have to live with them.
Yes.
But we shouldn't be, stymied by them and immobilized by them. So I'm saying, if there's a good idea and you think it's a good idea, begin the process of mobilizing on your idea and testing it.
Oh, I have, and I have tested it and mobilized and things like that, and it's tweaked,
okay.
And it's, but when you look at this particular society, you see that the people who are, for instance, someone called me the other day.
Oh, you have to, I hate to rush you, but we're getting close.
Someone called me the other day, and they're working in the Board of Health, and I have counseled them on health, and it's to do with health. And they will constantly push a certain idea because they work in it. But when they get ill, someone else, many people do this to me, they will call me and ask me for all kinds of stuff. But they work and they push another agenda on the public. But when they themselves need something, they come to me. And it's very interesting, but I know that time is gone.
Yeah. Well, look, I tell you this. Anybody wants to continue these discussions, I would be happy to do so. Send me a note at leadstories, L-E-I-D stories, at gmail.com. Also on Facebook at Lead Stories with Retrice Lead. This is really important work. It is, I think, as important as anything else, because we have to begin the process of speaking honestly without anybody being, you know, feeling offended. We're mature people and we're speaking frankly, and that is important work to do. I'm always awed by the education I get listening to the thoughts and the opinions of people who have profound things to say and profound things to contribute to a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue. So I relish that, and I feel very privileged to be in your company, and I thank you for having the trust that I would regard your opinions with the respect that they deserve. So let's meet again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And see where the conversation goes from here. Later on in the week, we'll get quite exciting, I think, but we'll be depending on you to show up at 1 o'clock. Tell everybody you know on the planet about PRN.FM and especially about your favorite show. Gee, I don't know what show that is. Might it be Lead Stories? Yes, it is. Tell everybody you know about the program, and let's grow this family, aggressively grow this family, because I really do enjoy it so. So thank you so much for listening. It's a pleasure and privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.